You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Today is Sunday, July 26, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear today rise from the voices of our hosts and guests alone. They are shaped by their experiences, their convictions, and their search for truth. They do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. What you hear in this space is unfiltered. What you hear in this space is honest. What you hear in this space belongs to the people who speak it. And now, with that clarity set before us, we begin. This Week in Palestine is not a place where truth tiptoes. It does not wait at the doorway or ask permission to enter. Here, truth walks in with its shoulders squared, its voice steady, its presence undeniable. Urgency is not an accessory in this space. It is the pulse that drives every word, every story, every breath we take behind this microphone. Clarity is not a choice. It is the duty we accept the moment we speak to you. And while our heart beats in Palestine, in the alleys of Jerusalem, in the camps of the West Bank, in the shattered streets of Gaza, our sight reaches far beyond the borders drawn by occupation or diplomacy. Because the forces shaping Palestinian life do not stop at walls or wire. They move through parliaments, through boardrooms, through the quiet corridors where powerful hands make decisions that ordinary people must live with. Wherever you are listening now, steering through the long, dark hours of your shift, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning air, or sitting in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. In this space, we do not sand down the truth to make it easier to swallow. We do not bend the story to comfort those who prefer silence. We do not dilute reality for the sake of anyone's convenience. Here, truth stands unfiltered. Resistance is not theory. It is breath. It is survival. Solidarity is not a slogan. It is a lineage carried from one generation to the next. The voices rising from occupied land do not waver. They rise alongside movements across the world that demand dignity, justice, and liberation. They remind us that struggle is never solitary. It is woven across borders, across histories, across the lives of people who refuse to surrender their humanity. This hour is not just a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the spark of defiance endures. Even when the world turns away, that spark refuses to die. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, complexity, and unbroken courage. We speak with intention because the stakes demand nothing less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite silence. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for freedom is shared. It crosses borders, and it remains sacred. Today, we examine a question that has become unavoidable. Why does speaking about Palestine, openly, honestly, and with evidence, trigger consequences that no other political topic seems to provoke? Across campuses, newsrooms, social platforms, and even private workplaces, people who speak about Israeli policies, military actions, or human rights violations often face suspensions, firings, demonetization, shadow bans, or public smear campaigns. The pattern is global. The message is unmistakable. You may speak freely unless your speech challenges Israel. This isn't a theoretical debate. It's lived reality. Students in the United States have been doxxed for chanting Free Palestine. Professors have lost jobs for discussing settler colonialism. Journalists have been pressured to soften language, avoid the word genocide, or frame Palestinian suffering as collateral damage rather than deliberate policy. Even humanitarian organizations have been attacked for documenting civilian casualties. And yet, the facts remain. International courts, human rights organizations, and legal experts have raised alarms about war crimes, forced displacement, and systematic violence against Palestinians. These are not fringe opinions. They are findings from bodies like the United Nations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the International Court of Justice. So why is discussing these findings treated as an act of rebellion? Today, we explore how this silence is manufactured. Governments and institutions often claim they are protecting communities from hate speech, but in practice, these policies are frequently used to shield a state, Israel, from accountability. Criticism of government actions becomes conflated with discrimination against people, and that conflation is weaponized to shut down debate, punish dissent, and erase Palestinian voices. Meanwhile, Palestinians continue to endure bombardment, displacement, and the daily reality of occupation. Their stories, their grief, their resistance, their humanity are filtered, sanitized, or ignored entirely. The people living the consequences of these policies are the ones least allowed to speak about them. This is not just a media problem. It is a moral problem. Freedom of speech is not tested by how we treat comfortable opinions. It is tested by how we treat the voices that challenge power. And today, the most heavily policed speech in the Western world is the speech that names Israeli violence, demands accountability, and insists that Palestinian lives are equal to all others. The battle for free expression is not abstract. It is happening now. It is happening to students, journalists, activists, and ordinary people who refuse to look away. And it is happening because truth, unfiltered, unsoftened, unapproved, threatens systems built on silence. As long as speaking about Palestine is treated as a crime, freedom of speech remains an illusion. And as long as Palestinians are denied the right to narrate their own suffering, the world remains complicit in that suffering. Today, we confront that hypocrisy. Today, we insist on truth. Today, we refuse to be silent. To confront this truth, I bring you today a conversation that cuts through the layers of censorship, political pressure, and the carefully engineered silence surrounding Palestine. Our host, Jamal El-Shayal, is one of the most respected investigative journalists of his generation. Known for his fearless reporting from conflict zones, Jamal has covered revolutions, wars, and political upheavals across the Middle East. His work has earned global recognition for its clarity, integrity, and refusal to sanitize reality. From Cairo's streets during the Arab Spring to Gaza under bombardment, Jamal has carried stories that others were too afraid or too restricted to tell. His interviews often become historical documents, capturing truths that institutions later attempt to bury. Today, Jamal sits down with a guest whose name has become synonymous with uncompromising scholarship and moral courage. Norman Finkelstein, political scientist, author, and one of the most controversial intellectual voices in modern discourse, has spent decades examining the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, human rights violations, and the politics of memory. His work is grounded in rigorous academic research, shaped by personal history, and sharpened by a lifelong commitment to justice. Finkelstein's books have influenced generations of activists, scholars, and truth seekers, including The Holocaust Industry, a critical examination of how historical trauma is politicized and weaponized. Gaza, an inquest into its martyrdom, a detailed, evidence-based investigation into Israeli military operations and their human cost. Knowing Too Much, a study of American liberalism and its contradictions regarding Israel and Palestine. I Accuse, a collection of essays confronting state violence, propaganda, and the suppression of dissent. Norman's career has been marked by controversy, not because his research lacks evidence, but because his conclusions challenge powerful political narratives. He has been denied tenure, banned from countries, and targeted by institutions, all for insisting that documented facts must be spoken aloud, even when they make people uncomfortable. Together, Jamal and Norman explore a question that sits at the heart of global political discourse. Why does free speech collapse the moment Israel is mentioned? Why are scholars, journalists, and ordinary people punished for describing what human rights organizations have already documented? Why is truth treated as a threat? This conversation is not polite, it is not softened, it is not designed to protect anyone's comfort. It is designed to reveal the machinery that decides which truths are allowed to exist and which truths must be buried. So now, let's listen together. Let's step into a space where truth is spoken without permission. Let's hear what was never meant to be heard.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jamal Al-Shayal. I'm a journalist, and currently I head up Al Jazeera's digital news content. And I am honored to sit beside a giant in the scholarly world, Dr. Norman Finkelstein, who many of you have read his books or listened to some of his lectures or watched on TV, including hopefully very soon on Al Jazeera in some shows and capacity. Our discussion today is Hypocrisy Unveiled, Uncovering the Truth or Uncovering Truth and the Battle of Free Speech. We've witnessed, particularly over the past couple of years, but I would say as Muslim communities around the world, double standards often in narrative, in reporting, in the implementation of law, in even issuing legislation, whereby often it is not the power of justice that is what prevails and what sets things, but unfortunately the injustice of power that often dictates these things. So over the next hour or so, we'll be discussing with Dr. Finkelstein some of these themes, drawing on his experience, outlook, and looking into different things. And we will try maybe in the last 15 minutes or so to take some questions with regards to any thoughts or queries that you guys may have. So Dr. Finkelstein, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start maybe with one of your personal experiences with regards to DePaul University, where you were refused a tenure there. And it seemed that was because of your work, your intellectual thought, and your views. Drawing on that experience of being unfairly or unjustly treated in a field that is meant to be there for freedom of expression and freedom of ideas, in a country that claims to represent and defend those concepts, in fact, alleges that those are the concepts that it is society is built on, and often claims that it is exporting these ideals to other nations and other countries. If you could talk us through a little bit about how that impacted you. Did it change your views in any way? Did it shape you in a certain form?
There was a very good little book written by a French philosopher named Julian Benda, B-E-N-D-A. And the book was titled, in French, La Trahison des Clercs, which in English it came out as The Treason of the Intellectuals. And one of the central theses of the book was the following, that there are two sets of values in this world. One is to pursue fame and fortune. That's what Benda calls the earthly values, the material values, those who set out in life to pursue fame and fortune. And then there's a second kind of values. They are what Benda calls the spiritual values. And the spiritual values are to pursue truth and justice. And the essence of Benda's book is to say that these two sets of values always come into conflict. The more successful you are at achieving the material values, fame and fortune, the more successful you are at achieving the material values, the more or the less you will be pursuing truth and justice. Those sets of values always come into conflict. And he goes through the long history of Western civilization. He looks at a Socrates. He looks at a Jesus Christ. And he says, if you pursue truth and justice to its limit, if you pursue it to its limit, then inevitably you will be killed. That's the nature of the real world. And so, if you were to take modern examples, Malcolm X ended up dead at a young age, 39. Martin Luther King ended up dead at a young age, also age 39. You take a case like Nelson Mandela, he spent 29 years, the entirety really of his adult life, he spent them in jail. That was a living death. In fact, if you look at the history of Nelson Mandela, from fairly early on, the government of South Africa said to him, at that point, the apartheid regime in South Africa, they said to him, Mr. Mandela, all you have to do is renounce armed struggle. Say you are against armed resistance, and we will free you. He refused. He was going to stay true to his truth and to justice, and he was willing to pay the price of, in effect, a living death until he was freed, but already at a very late age in his life. So that's my way of answering that I recognized from fairly early on, and my mentor for the entirety of my adult life was Noam Chomsky, who some of you may know. And he warned me from early on. He said that if I pursue this route, I would pay a heavy price. And I remember his wife, who was also a close friend of mine, her name was Carol Chomsky. She once reprimanded her husband, Noam Chomsky, in my presence for not warning me that I would get into, so to speak, this mess. And I told her, Carol, you're mistaken. Your husband did warn me many times about the consequences of pursuing this path in life. And I have to say, it may sound like an exaggeration, but I have to say, I never was even tempted for a millisecond. I was never even tempted to go down the path of fame and fortune. And as I look back, I would say, as the clouds darken, the long shadow sets in, the clock approaches midnight, I have no regrets. I am kind of a little bit proud that I stayed true to the memory of the martyrdom of my parents, and I stayed true to my youthful convictions about never joining this world. And as the African American spiritual says, I don't want, I don't want, I don't want to get adjusted to this world. I'm going to get to a world that's better. I don't want to get adjusted to this world. I never adjusted. And for me, a little pride in that. Thank you.
That is both very, very humbling and inspiring. And I think it is something that is at core, both in terms of those who are looking for at things from a political and social justice perspective, as well as from maybe even a spiritual journey in life and understanding that true meaning and what people seek. But there are challenges, you know, as you say, it doesn't come without a cost, and often those costs are very difficult. One of the things that I think maybe has become even more, or has become clearer over the past few years, when we look at just how ingrained and how systematic the hypocrisy or double standards is within all the powerful sectors of society, right? So maybe 20 years ago, I think back at my university days during the 9/11 era and war in Iraq, and there was a conviction that, you know, mass mobilization, for example, in the UK, there was the 2 million man march. It's only the fringe elements. Bush was a fringe element to certain things. It was, at least that's how it was perceived, right? There was always another alternative and so forth. But when we're looking at today's world, when we see crackdowns on student encampments, when we see corporate banks freezing people's random charities' assets, when we see media institutions firing people because they've put a pin of a watermelon on, and we see that, what is it that needs to be done in order to address this systematic, ingrained, institutionalized, basically colonialist mentality in some respects, and sometimes it's just very racist or sometimes very classist because there are different drivers to it. What needs to be done to dismantle this, not simply just oppose it?
In any phenomenon, in my opinion, any political phenomenon, social phenomenon, you have to always look at both sides. It's never a unilateral or a single picture. So the first thing I believe you have to ask yourself is, what accounts for this brutal crackdown on freedom of speech in the US, in Canada, in the UK, in France? Probably the worst place right now is in Germany. What accounts for it? And there's an interesting fact there. The fact is this: as most of you have figured out, I'm an old timer. And as I was telling the driver on the way here, he said, is this your first visit to Toronto? I think you were here a few years ago. I said, a few years ago? I was here before you were born. I did come to Toronto to speak in the late 70s and the early 1980s on Israel and Palestine. In fact, just for the sake of the Muslim Arab community here, I distinctly remember when I came to Toronto, there was already back then, we're talking about a half century ago, there already was a Palestinian community here in Toronto of expatriates from the Middle East. And one thing that stuck with me was one Palestinian said to me, it's not easy to be a refugee anywhere, but if I had a choice of being a refugee anywhere in the world, it would be Canada. Canada was a remarkably tolerant, decent place under Pierre Trudeau. In fact, he invented the concept of multiculturalism. It started with Pierre Trudeau. Back then, there used to be a survey of what's called a happiness scale. Where in the world is the population happiest? Every year, Canada won. Every year, the happiest population was Canada. In any event, I go back a ways. And back then, there weren't the kinds of brutal crackdowns on free speech that there are now. Now, the question is why? And the answer, in my opinion, was back then, the Israeli side, supported by their supporters in the US and Canada, they were very confident that they could win the battle of public opinion. They thought they had the facts on their side. They thought that they had truth on their side. And they had sufficient money and power that they can overwhelm the other side, which in many respects, because it was new to the country, were not able, they didn't yet have the intellectual tools, they weren't able to refute the other side, the Israeli side, the Israeli propaganda. So they weren't afraid, the Israelis and their supporters, they weren't afraid to argue in public, to engage in public debate. Now, it's true, some people, they tried hard to silence. Professor Chomsky, Edward Said, for those of you who remember him, a few. But in general, to use the current jargon, they controlled the narrative. What happened is, now, by now, enough of the truth has broken into the public. Enough of the truth has broken into the mainstream. And so it's because they lost the battle of public opinion. They know they can no longer prevail in the public square or in the social media. It's because they know they lost that they're so open, so brazen, so flagrant in wielding the blackmail weapon and threatening, if you don't do as what we say, we're going to cut your funding. So it's true that there has been a brutal crackdown. Of that, I have no doubt. But you have to grasp the other side. There's a brutal crackdown because they lost. They lost the battle of public opinion.
So I want to interject with a small, quick story here that will be a conduit for from this to the next, obviously, the crackdown. I was one of the guests that they tried to ban from entering here in Canada. And what happened, for those who don't know, I was on board the first aid flotilla that was going to Gaza in 2010. And I reported on that, and we were abducted from international waters, as the United Nations itself actually found, and captured by the Israeli special forces for a few days. On board, actually, interestingly enough, was, I would say, at least 24 Canadians who were part of the mission, and some of them were actually severely injured, aside from obviously the 10 people who were martyred on that ship. And when I applied as a British national, you apply for the ETA, the visa waiver program, and I had one that was running because I've been to Canada a few times. Suddenly I found it was revoked a few days ago. And they said, well, the reason why it was revoked, according to them, was because you failed to declare that you were arrested by Israel in 2010. So I proceeded to clarify that, firstly, I wasn't arrested, we were abducted, and secondly, wasn't in Israel, was in international waters. But what is bizarre is that Canada, as you mentioned, that has a very proud history of not simply also multiculturalism, but also usually standing on the right side when it came to press freedom and freedom of expression, was allowing itself to be used essentially by a foreign entity or its proxies to dictate its border securities, who it allows in and who it doesn't. And that, if it weren't a sign, a clear sign of desperation from that side, of trying to exert all and any measure and force people, you know, now even its allies in the West, they're not allowed to think, you will do as we say otherwise. And I think that really does speak to what you were saying there. Where it becomes maybe a bit more challenging here, and I'll say this as Muslims and Arabs and so forth, obviously, is where there is the often, particularly from the Israeli government, this intentional attempt to mix anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And I think that is something that has often been used. It's like almost the play card that or the ace card that is used. And I would love to hear from you, with your history, personal and academic, how to understand this, how to unpack it, and how to be careful with regards to it, please.
Well, just on a personal or a scholarly note, your first name?
Jamal.
Jamal was, for the younger people in this room, he was on an international flotilla, the flagship of which was named the Mavi Marmara. I assume you were on the Mavi Marmara, and it was attacked on May 31st in international waters by Israeli commandos. And at the end of the day, 9 people were killed, and then one person who was in a coma, he died subsequently, so 10 people were killed. And it was a very brutal assault on the Mavi Marmara, and it became an international incident. Because normally, when Israel does that, nobody cares. It gets maybe 5 minutes of news coverage and then forgotten. But in this case, the flotilla of, I should point out, because I make assumptions that people don't know because you're younger. And for me, it's yesterday, but for you, it was when I was in my mother's womb or before. Israel, beginning in 2006, imposed this brutal blockade on Gaza, in which pretty much, believe it or not, it pretty much forbade anything from entering Gaza. Baby chicks were banned. Chocolate was banned. Nutmeg was banned. Children's toys were banned. Children's notebooks were banned. And it was all very calculated. It's very hard to believe, but the Israelis calculated the caloric intake, how many calories the population of Gaza consumed each day. And they literally, we have the documents, they literally calculated how to keep Gaza just above the level of starvation. Just above the level of starvation, because they wanted to create so much horror in Gaza that the people would overthrow the Hamas government. And so an international flotilla was organized. It happened that the main impetus behind that flotilla was Turkey, or a Turkish organization called IHHA, IHH. And it was because it was a medium-level power, namely Turkey, that this particular flotilla got international attention. But it was an interesting fact that the United Nations, the Secretary General at the time, Ban Ki-moon, in collusion with the head of the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda, they all conspired to crush an investigation of what happened aboard the Mavi Marmara. And for those of you who are interested in the very boring details, I go through it in a couple of books, and then I go through it again in the book that I've written that's going to come out hopefully next month, on corruption in these international organizations. Now, as to the question, I think it's not a tough question, it's a kind of murky. Murky means it's unclear. What happened is, in my opinion, and obviously reasonable people can disagree, that Israel's supporters, which included most of the major representative Jewish organizations around the world, they carried on in such a brazen way over the past 20 or 30 years, so reckless in their brutal assaults on those who sought to criticize what Israel is doing, in trying to silence any criticism of Israel, that when the horror in Gaza unfolded in real time on the social media, a lot of public opinion shifted, and a lot of resentment rose to the surface at the way these Jewish organizations and Jewish individuals carried on. And so, in my opinion, for those of you who remember the famous quote by Malcolm X, I assume most people in the audience know who he is. When John F. Kennedy was assassinated November 22nd, 1963, when he was assassinated, Malcolm X, who at that point belonged to the Nation of Islam, he was asked by reporters, well, what do you think about the Kennedy assassination? And his famous response was, the chickens have come home to roost, by which he meant the U.S. carries on in such a violent way all around the world, overthrowing governments here, repressing movements for freedom there, that now the violence that the U.S. had inflicted on the rest of the world, that violence now came back to the United States. The chickens have come home to roost. And I think that now a lot of the resentment at the way Jews have carried on, Jewish organizations have carried on, I think it's now come to the surface, and there is a certain amount of, I would call it, murkiness about where the legitimate criticism of Israel ends and where resentment against Jews in general begins. But that's a problem. That's a problem that was created by this kind of brutal and blanket support of Israel's criminal actions over such a long period of time. So now I believe we're in a murky area about it. I don't know whether most people here are of the left politically, of the center politically, or of the right politically. But if you are of the right wing, let's say you are a MAGA person in the United States, sympathy for oppressed peoples has never been a hallmark of the right wing. Do you think that Donald Trump spends many nights in tears over hunger in the world? Doesn't sound right. Does he expend much moral energy on injustice in the world? That doesn't sound right. That's always been a left-wing cause: national liberation, redistribution of wealth, trying to bring justice into the world. But now, Gaza's become a right-wing cause. It's become the cause of Tucker Carlson. It's become the cause of Candace Owens. It's a very strange thing. When I see those people suddenly sensitized to the suffering of the people of Palestine or Gaza, I have to ask myself, is it Gaza or is it capitalizing on the new resentments that have come to the surface against Jews? I'm not sure. I know that Mr. Carlson likes to say, I don't mean all Jews. It's not all Jews, just the Jews. Well, there's a famous line from Shakespeare's Hamlet. The line is, methinks she doth protest too much. That the more you say it's not all Jews, you begin to wonder, why is he protesting so much? So I think we've entered, in my opinion, a problematic moment, but I also believe you reap what you have sown. You reap what you have sown.
Thank you. I think from this, before I'll ask one more question, and then maybe, like I said, we'll open up for some comments and questions. I want to move towards this, as you say, maybe modern jargon of narratives and the war of narratives. And like I said, when I first saw you earlier today, I remember the first time listening, I was still a student back in London. And I think maybe the first conference was a Palestine conference that was in Manchester was organized. 2001 or 2002, I was with Dr. Rada Karmi, a Palestinian academic, and Leila Khaled, who, Allah give her a long life, she's a bit sick these days, I hear. We were speaking on a panel, and obviously I'm the youngest of them as a student organizer there. And my personal view is that I believe in a one-state solution that allows for everybody to live in, because I could never understand the logic between legalizing theft of land before 1967 and making it illegal after 1967. That's my own personal opinion. And I said it. And both these women, who I have huge respect for and have done a million things that are much greater than, but they took me up on it after and said, "You can't say this." And I said, "Why can't I say this?" They said, "Well, sympathy and people won't align with us, and you have to talk about two states, and you have to talk about," and I couldn't wrap my head around it, right? Moving now to 40 years after that, or 25 years or 30 years after now, I won't say a one-state solution is something that everybody accepts, but it's definitely accepted as a intellectually sound and logical discourse that could never have had before. That shift in actually people now not taking point blank those alleged facts that you mentioned, that were the case back in the 70s when you came here to Canada, whatnot, that there was an assumption that the facts were on site. How do you perceive that shift? And is it just a flash in history, or is it something that is the beginning of the undoing of that apartheid state? And what are people's responsibilities across the different fields that they may work in or study in and so forth, in order to ensure that and it doesn't have to be a universal narrative that everybody agrees on, but at least one that secures people's basic human rights is achieved?
There are two questions that are wrapped up in that question, or at least two that I would want to address. The first question is, are we seeing a shift that will be enduring, or is it a flash in the pan? Now, I've lived long enough to see many shifts in public opinion which did not last. There was a shift in public opinion after Israel invaded Lebanon in June 1982. The estimates are between 15 and 20,000 Lebanese and Palestinians were killed during that invasion, overwhelmingly civilians. There was a shift in public opinion after the Palestinian uprising in 1988, what was called the First Intifada, where unarmed children were, by the order of the defense minister at the time, Yitzhak Rabin — he later won the Nobel Peace Prize — his order was that the Israeli soldiers should inflict, quote, force, might, and beatings on the children. There was a shift in public opinion after Operation Cast Lead in 2008-09. But most of those shifts in public opinion did not significantly endure. But there is the question whether Gaza marks a turning point, that there is, to use the expression, there's no going back. Israel has so completely and totally I won't say discredited itself. I would say exposed itself, that you can't turn back the clock. The train has left the station. The boat has left the harbor. This is a sea change in perceptions of Israel. I myself, I ponder that question, and I can't answer it. I'm just not certain. I'm going to have to wait and see a year or two from now whether public opinion has now stabilized at what you might call a new normal. And the new normal is Israel is a genocidal state. It's hard to predict. The second question is the world ready, as
Jamal.
As Jamal correctly said, there was a period where the notion of a one-state solution was taboo. It wasn't even given any credence. For the new generation, it's changed. I think in part, it's changed for the following reason. The Nazi Holocaust is now 80 years ago, 1945, it ends. The younger generations, that memory is not fresh anymore for that generation, for the new generation. There are many wonderful things to say about young people, but there are also some negative things to say. And one is they have no historic memory, which is bad enough. But what's worse, I believe, they have no historic curiosity. If it happened more than two weeks ago, not interested. And so part of that lack of historical memory and lack of historical curiosity, there is no memory really of the Nazi Holocaust. And that served for a generation as the main justification for not just the founding of the State of Israel, but also for excusing all its crimes. Which were there to see, if you wanted to see them. It was a very striking fact, which I don't think has been sufficiently commented on, that when the Gaza genocide began, when it began, some of you will remember that the very first card Israel tried to play, the very first card was the first few weeks, up until the end of the first month, the first thing they kept saying was, it's the biggest mass killing of Jews since the Holocaust. The biggest mass killing of Jews since the Holocaust. The first reflex of Israel was try to drag in the Holocaust. But it was very notable. After the first month, they stopped. They realized it fell flat in public opinion. People didn't want to hear about it. People didn't want to care, didn't care about it. And so it is true that public opinion is at a different place now in terms of solutions to the conflict. I would say the following. Number one, politics and law always have two elements often in conflict with each other. One element is what's politically feasible. Element number two, what does law and morality mandate? What's practical versus what should be under law and under morality. Now, Jamal raised an interesting question. He said, as a young man, I could not understand why it was legitimate for Israel to steal part of the Palestinian homeland in 1948, but it was illegitimate for Israel to steal the rest of the homeland after the June 1967 war. So Jamal says, if it was illegitimate in 67 to take the West Bank and Gaza, why wasn't it illegitimate to take what became the State of Israel in 1948? And my answer to Jamal would be, because law and morality, when it comes to trying to resolve conflicts, it's always in contention with what's politically feasible, what's politically possible. And the international community decided roughly UN Resolution 242, and shortly thereafter, that was what was politically feasible, but also had aspects of justice, was to leave Israel in what's called the June 1967 borders, and to create a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. That was the international consensus, unsatisfactory to those who think like Jamal, that it's either just or it's unjust. It's either legitimate or it's illegitimate. I don't think that's how politics works. Where we're headed towards the future, I would say the picture right now is very nebulous, and that we should focus less on solutions, and we should focus instead right now, before the dust has settled and we know what the map of the Middle East will look like. Right now, it's still very unclear. Right now, we should focus not on solutions, we should focus on salvaging what can be salvaged in Gaza and also in the West Bank, which is right now under brutal assault.
All right, thank you very much. Of course, that is, unfortunately, it's not how politics is run. We wish it was run based on justice, but yes, the reality of the world is different. One of the questions that has come from the audience, many distinguished Jewish personalities oppose Israel and have come out in recent years and expressed their opposition. But what they're questioning is, what do ordinary Jews living inside Israel, what is their opinion? Has it changed in one way or the other, either more in support of or against?
In the Jewish communities around the world, I won't say all. I can say the UK, I can say the US, and I would guess also Canada. I would say they divide into three thirds. One third, mostly over 50 or 60, one third are still blindly faithful to Israel. One third have reservations, but haven't reached the point of completely rejecting it as a source of inspiration and identity. And one third which has had enough with that state, and for whom Israel is no longer a source of identity or inspiration. That's Jews living outside. Some places, they're still terrible, like in France, totally lunatic. Germany, there's not many Jews in Germany, but totally lunatic. But that wasn't the fullness of the question. The question is the state of Israel. In my opinion, one, maybe not the only, but certainly one of the most important facts about what happened in the last 2.5 years is that it's incorrect to describe it as a state-sponsored genocide. That is not correct. It was and continues to be a national project. It's not as if Mr. Netanyahu and his cohorts, they are acting in a vacuum, unrelated or disconnected from the population. Their actions, their orders, all of that across the board, with only the tiniest of exceptions, is supported wholeheartedly by the whole of Israeli Jewish society. Israel's probably the most polled, P-O-L-L-E-D, polled place on God's earth. Because anything an Israeli Jew does, whether he has an omelet or cereal for breakfast, whether the omelet is sunny side up or sunny side down, anything an Israeli Jew does has to be of the utmost interest to the whole of humanity. This stupefyingly narcissistic society, this stupefyingly self-righteous society, they're constantly being polled. And what do the polls show? In the course of the genocide in Gaza, one poll asked Israeli Jews, when the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, when they enter a city, should they kill everybody in the city? That was the question. Should they kill everybody in the city? Nearly half of Israeli Jews answered yes to that question. A few months later, a question was put to all Israelis. Are there any innocents in Gaza? Is anybody innocent in Gaza? 64% of all Israelis answered no. If you factor off the non-Israeli, non-Jewish Israelis, which is about, depending on how you judge the borders of Israel, it's between 15 and 20% of Israeli society is non-Jewish. If you factor them away, it comes to about 70 to 75% of Israeli Jews believe there are no innocents in Gaza. Bear in mind, half, 48% of Gaza's population are children. And 70 to 75% say there are no innocents in Gaza. Every few weeks in these 2.5 years, there were public opinion polls taken among Israeli Jews asking the question, do you believe Israel is using too little force in Gaza, just the right amount of force in Gaza, or too much force in Gaza? Every single poll, everyone, found among Israeli Jews, only 5% thought that Israel was using too much force. Among the other 95%, 40% of that 95%, 40% thought Israel was using too little force in Gaza. It's a very ugly picture. I don't think you can get around the fact that Israel has turned into not a homicidal state, it's turned into a homicidal, genocidal society. Does that mean it's irredeemable? I don't know. I know that Professor Chomsky, he very rarely spoke about the Nazi Holocaust, but he once said something that kept. He said he would describe the Nazi Holocaust as that the most fantastic outbreak of collective madness in human history. The most fantastic outbreak of collective madness in human history. There were two key words there, fantastic and collective. It was a collective enterprise, a collective undertaking. But I don't think Germany is a great place, but as compared to most other European countries, it's not worse. It's to some extent, it did redeem itself. Most people in this room will not remember Japan during those years. You know, the Japanese, they murdered 26 million Chinese. 26 million Chinese. They were absolutely ruthless and bloodthirsty. But it's also true to say they changed. Nobody would nowadays describe Japan as among the world's most ruthless and bloodthirsty countries, though it was. So I believe you have to balance two facts. Number one, you have to be honest about the fact that Israel as a society is a horrible, horrible place. Unspeakable in the way it now carries on. But the other fact is, I'm speaking as an American, and I don't know your country's history well enough. Speaking as an American, what we did to the Native Americans in our country was not much better than what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. I would just want to note that I had been reading a lot about the abolitionists in the U.S., that is the Americans, whites in particular, but not just whites, who opposed slavery in the middle of the 19th century. They were extremely courageous. They were extremely principled. It's a very inspiring story. But I have to tell you something which really kind of shocked me. The abolitionists, those who gave over their lives to freeing the slaves, they were every bit as horrible in their attitudes towards the Native Americans. Even people, for some of you may know, even black abolitionists, African-American abolitionists, like Frederick Douglass, when it came to the Native Americans, all the same prejudices, all the same brutality. So I think we have to find the right balance between recognizing the horrors of that society, unfortunately, a bloodthirsty, crazed, self-righteous, a country of self-righteous, nauseatingly narcissistic Jewish supremacists, but also recognizing that many other countries passed through that phase and were able to redeem themselves.
We are running a little bit over time, but I want to ask one last question, because I always think it's important to come away with something practical to do. And one of the audience has a very practical question, but if you could kindly answer it, if possible, in a minute or a minute and a half, which is, the president, I guess, works in academia or studies, says, how do we tackle in our academic institutions the Zionist groups that spread propaganda against us, calling us pro-Hamas and so forth whenever we talk or about Palestine or express solidarity? So if there is one or two very straightforward practical pieces of advice for those working in academia who they can fend off from those smear campaigns.
Well, I don't want to limit my answer to academia, because the problem is everywhere. If you work in a hospital, doctors, nurses, they're terrified of posting anything on their social media that may be sympathetic to Gaza or critical of Israel. It's a countrywide, nationwide problem. And my answer is, the most important thing that needs to be done now is to win back, to wrest, W-R-E-S-T means seize, to wrest back the right to free speech. Once we have won back that right to free speech, then I believe the facts are on our side. The truth is on our side, and actually, a large part of the general public is already on our side. The problem is not that they're smearing with claims about being terrorists and this and that. That's not the problem. The problem is you can't answer. There's been a total crackdown on the right to free speech. And so I believe going forward, at least for the foreseeable future, the right slogan is Free Gaza, Free Speech, or Free Speech, Free Gaza. If you have a T-shirt on the front of the T-shirt, it should say Free Gaza. And then if somebody thinks that you are just a wild-eyed terrorist supporter, the back of that T-shirt should say free speech. Mm-hmm. And then I believe you can win over most people. In the United States, in Canada, free speech is considered a basic value. Mm-hmm. If you combine Free Gaza with free speech, I think you can prevail, though I will acknowledge it's a tough battle, but I think it can be won.
Dr. Norman Finkelstein, thank you very much for your time. Just before we close, if you allow me, just for our audience, considering this is a Muslim community event, you were mentioning a couple of points about when you were looking at the slave abolition movement and the unfortunate hypocrisy amongst those who had done something very...
I would say it was not even hypocrisy. I don't think they were even aware.
Aware of it.
They were not. They did not understand Native Americans as being human. They did not. Just like Israel does not understand Palestinians.
And one of the things, I
Arabs.
Guess, that it just brought to mind, we have in Islamic tradition a couple of things that came out from it for the audience to maybe remind themselves of. There was a saying of Umar, the second caliph after the Prophet, peace be upon him, who questioned, how can a human be enslaved when they were born free or the mothers bore them free. And herein it is a human, it's not a Muslim, it's not an Arab, it is not of any race, and it is the premise of Islam that humans, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, has created them with dignity and to be free regardless of their race, religion, and faith. Even the Prophet, peace be upon him, has a saying of, you should always support your brother if he is oppressed or if he is an oppressor. And the companions asked, well, how can we do that if he is the oppressor? They said, you correct him, you don't allow him to oppress. And I think the universality of human rights, when it's left to mankind to decide, is often, at least this is from my opinion, Yani, when it's left for mankind to decide, this is where, unfortunately, the balance of justice often finds the scales not balanced. But when we accept that we all together are here as God's creation, and nobody is born better than anybody else, and each of us have that right to freedom and dignity, it is in that belief that, inshallah, we can find some sort of equality in a very unjust and dark world. Just a couple of words that I wanted to share with everyone, and I thank you again for your time. Please, a huge round of applause for Dr. Norman Finkelstein.
Russell reporting from the WZBC studios at Boston College. This is This Week in Palestine, carried by Truth and Justice Radio, the broadcast that doesn't flinch from complexity, that pushes into the hard questions, and where the echoes of history collide with the pressure of the present. And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The slow dimming of a lantern, the quiet settling of truth after an hour that asked much of the heart. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to fade, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that works tirelessly to silence it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour grounded in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not evaporate when the headlines shift or when the cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or cracked open a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care, stay grounded, stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine, from the river to the sea. Falastin Hara.